order. And I'm going to take one bill out of order to open a public hearing on 2625. Diane?
Chairperson, members of the committee, House Bill 2625 comes to us from Oregon Hypnotherapy Association. It establishes a licensing program for hypnotherapists and creates this hypnotherapy board in the health licensing office. It establishes procedures for the board, confidentiality requirements for communication between hypnotherapists and clients, and imposes civil penalties of up to $1,000 for violations of this act. It punishes violations of the act by a maximum of 30 days imprisonment, $1,000 fine, or both. There are no amendments, but we have people from the Hypnotherapy Association not willing to testify.
Okay, do you guys all want to come up together or individually?
If we allow Dr. Peterson to speak first, and then I will speak afterwards.
Okay. Dr. Peterson. No.
I would rip.
Welcome.
Thanks,
go ahead.
I'd like to support bringing a board for the hypnotherapist so that we have.
Could you identify yourself?
Sorry. Patricia Peterson. I would like to support having a board for the hypnotherapist so that we can have a reliable source where people register and some credentialing process occur. At this point, I think it's an important option for patients in many aspects of care, and I think it would be helpful in terms of establishing a program whereby we're working with people credentialed, noted to be boarded or specialized within that field.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Did you want to?
I got Dr. Peterson to talk about some of her personal experiences.
Well, you have the microphone.
I'll try to be brief. I've had both professional and personal experiences with hypnotherapy. I've had patients who underwent hypnotherapy as an option for deep relaxation and labor, as opposed to using other programs such as Bradley or Lamaze technique. This helps the woman to relax through the difficult stages of labor. I've had patients who were so alert, yet relaxed and capable of control and full experience of the birth process that they had noticed other people in the room had left the lens cap on their camera when taking pictures. And so it was a very pleasant experience for the mother to enjoy the birth, yet still be able to cope with the discomfort of labor. I've also had gynecologic patients who needed both counseling or relaxation techniques to deal with certain gynecologic problems, and researching hypnotherapy was one of the leading options for them. There was no drug or magical cure, and in referring the patient, I felt that the patient had more success in that mode of therapy than perhaps we could have in trying new medications or and having limited resources to offer her in her current therapy. My sister had recently had a baby and used hypnotherapy as well for relaxation technique, and it was very impressive how she was able to listen to a tape and to relax herself through hard labor, to cope well with it, and to maintain her strength for delivery and to enjoy the whole experience without medication, without drug. That was a positive experience. I think it should be an option for Oregonians. I think it should be provided only through a credentialed person. Many of these circumstances, especially my patient had need of gynecologic care in addition to the assistance that hypnotherapy gave her, if we've had someone who didn't understand that this may need additional therapy or didn't understand psychological concerns and how other areas of medicine can benefit and interact, I think it would have been to her detriment. So certainly we need someone who understands the importance of counseling and has some expertise in that before they just embark on the techniques of hypnotherapy. And the techniques themselves, some of them are rather simple, but I think that you could cause great harm if you don't use them appropriately. And my hope is establishing a board would help to bring in people who have such expertise to be beneficial to our patients.
Dr. Skolnick?
Thank you. I'm going to read this because I've never done this before in my life. So with your patience and understanding, I'll do the best I can. Honorable Chairman Jeff Cruz and Vice Chairs Bill Morissetti and Bill Girard, and I hope I pronounced those names correctly.
Close.
Members of the committee. Was I close?
Close, yeah.
My purpose in appearing before you today is to express the need for licensing of hypnotherapists in Oregon. First of all, let me talk about what hypnotherapy is. Webster's Collegiate Dictionary defines hypnotherapy as psychotherapy that facilitates suggestion, re-education, or analysis by means of hypnosis. Hypnosis is a natural state of deep physical and mental relaxation. But at this time, let me tell you that all of hypnosis is self-hypnosis. There isn't any other kind. All I or any other qualified individual can do is act as a teacher or as a guide to help someone reach that deep state of relaxation, which I call the place of tranquility. It is a place which will enable the subconscious part of the brain to take a more active role in helping to modify a habit or change a personality trait that one wishes to. We use self-hypnosis to program the mind many times in life. For example, I'm sure everybody here drives a car. When we first learned the process, it was basically the following instructions for me a long time ago. It was adjust the seat comfortably, adjust the rear view mirror, put key in ignition, then there were no seat belts, put gear shift in neutral, step on the clutch before starting the engine, otherwise it jumps on you, check traffic before pulling away from the curb. Of course, today a lot of steps have been eliminated by automatic drive and safety belts. However, no matter how we were trained, our subconscious does that for us automatically. The conscious keeps us safe, but we now don't think of each step as we need. We have used self-hypnosis to program ourselves. The use of hypnotherapy is nothing more than harnessing the imagination through visualization and guided imagery. If you will allow me to demonstrate how through visualization and the imagination of the subconscious can control the muscles and organs of the body.
Try it on our chair,
please. Well, I'm going to do it on all of you. Would you place your arms directly in front of you, please, and close your eyes?
Yeah.
Good idea.
Please.
Is this how you get
now, with your eyes closed, turn your right palm upward.
Right.
Eyes closed, Representative. Now, using your imagination, imagine I'm going to put a very, very heavy dictionary in that right palm. And on the left wrist, I'm going to tie a string attached to a balloon filled with helium gas. Just allow those forces to operate on your body, finding one arm getting very, very heavy, the other one getting very, very light. Now open your eyes and look around. Tell me who the best subject would be. What this does is allow the therapist to determine through this and other tests which clients will be better suited to use hypnotherapy to help themselves. This, among other testing methods, is used to determine the best candidate for treatment. A qualified hypnotherapist will not take on a patient unless the following criteria are met. 1, the subject has a sincere desire to change. 2, and the reason for change is valid. 3, the individual shows the ability to harness the imagination well, such as the test or test given. Let me give you an example of what I mean. A client was referred to me by her physician to stop smoking. When I asked her why she wanted to become a non-smoker, she replied that her doctor told her she had to. I then said to her, "I'm aware of that, but why do you want to become a non-smoker?" She replied, "I don't really want to, but he said I had to." I did not take her on as a client, as I felt it would be taking her money knowing her motivation would not allow her to succeed, and reported that to the physician that made the referral. He later informed me that the patient went to another hypnotherapist and told the doctor it didn't work, and it wasn't going to work because she didn't have the proper motivation, as I knew that hypnotherapy would not help her due to the non-desire for change. In May of 1966, on Channel 6, Coin TV News reported a case in the state of Washington, and I would ask you to allow me to show the committee a copy of that news report. With your permission.
96,
I'm sorry.
Rice had 17 sessions at Gina Gamage's office in her home in Vancouver, Washington. That's what Rice says. Gamage told her that a satanic cult was after her, that her parents had sexually abused her.
As the memories got worse, I questioned her. How can this happen? I mean, some of this stuff I shouldn't have survived. And she said, it doesn't matter if it's true or not, you just have to own it. Which means you have to believe it. You have to accept it.
Rice did believe it, so much so, one night in June 1992, she got into her car and ran from the so-called cult. She was so desperate, she fled to a hospital in Salem. There, Rice says, the doctor called in a cult expert, a woman claiming to be a witch. Then the hospital kicked them all out. That's when the nightmare turned fatal. Rice fled, believing she was under control of that witch. She let go of her car steering, causing an accident which killed a Portland man. Rice was convicted of first-degree manslaughter, but was found to be insane at the time. She served no jail time, but did sue her therapist. They settled for $700,000. University of Washington professor of social work John Conley investigated the case.
Certainly, this one case is so horrible and the conduct is so bad. The state should investigate to determine if she should continue the practice.
I think she should be accountable for her actions. I am, and I believe she should be.
Rice says she plans to lobby the legislature to pass laws with stricter regulations regarding mental health counselors. Megan Black, News Center 6.
The counselor, Gina Gamage, refused Megan's request for an interview. However, Gamage's attorney says his client denies any wrongdoing, and the $700,000 settlement was made at the request of the counselor's insurance company.
will respect a hypnotherapist say it is not possible for a therapist to make you do something that is out of your character, and they say it is not difficult to find a good therapist. The most important thing to do is interview the therapist on the phone before you seek counseling. You should ask a couple of key questions, such as what their specialty is. Inquire about their training, where they got it, and how many hours they've had, and give them a quick thumbnail sketch of your problem and ask how they would treat it. There's one surefire way to decide whether a hypnotherapist is going to work for you. The experts say if a therapist has answers as to the origin of your problem and the solution right off the bat, you should find somebody else. Randy Quarry is coming back to give us a snapshot.
Rachel? By requiring hypnotherapists to be licensed, the public would be protected from being treated by someone who is not qualified. And therefore, it could not happen in Oregon. There are many wonderful success stories ranging from medical doctors like Bernie Siegel, MD, in his book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, to reports from the Menager Clinic. In my own practice, I'd like to share with you just a couple of highlights. A client that was suffering from anxiety due to an up-and-coming kidney transplant, as his father was the donor, and he was fearful of the results. By treating him, we were able not only to eliminate his fears and aid him to look forward to the experience, but later were advised by the surgeon that his relaxed state enabled him to control the flow of blood, thereby eliminating the need for extra blood during the surgery. A local woman who suffered low self-esteem within 3 sessions was able to change her attitude about herself so much that her fellow workers noticed the difference in her, as well as the way she groomed herself, feeling much more secure. Channel 2 News reported of a client of mine that was allergic to anesthetic but needed to have a root canal. Again, with your permission, I'd like to show the committee that report.
Need some sort of anesthesia to undergo painful dental procedures. But who ever heard of going through a root canal without pain relief? Well, in tonight's Senior Health Report, our medical reporter Paul Adonis tells us how some patients are undergoing no drug dentistry. We're not talking about the gas here either, are we, Paul?
No, we're talking
about drugs at all.
We're talking about the answer is all in your mind. Yeah, we're talking about hypnotherapy. And that in the hands of trained professionals is becoming more recognized as an alternative to conventional anesthesia in this end of life.
Why don't you put him in the position you want him, and I will do it this and all the right way.
Nick Threadgill sinks back in the dental chair and eagerly awaits a procedure that would make most of us cringe, a root canal.
It's kind of free to go down deep and relaxation.
Threadgill is allergic to anesthesia and is undergoing the procedure without jaw-numbing medication.
You'll find that as I push on your hand, you'll just go a little bit deeper now. A little bit deeper.
Yet he's feeling no pain with the help of hypnosis. While he's in the dental chair, he is aware of what's going on around him. But with the help of hypnotherapist Dr. Larry Skolnick, he goes on a mental vacation.
My visualization when I go under this thing is that I'm on this very beautiful lake, sunshine, very bright, nice clear turquoise blue lake. I'm just riding across the lake.
Even as the dental drill bores through enamel and into sensitive roots in his teeth, Threadgill doesn't so much as flinch.
The patient is so relaxed and so cooperative that we're able to do a lot more, and so that takes a lot of attention off of me.
Dr. Solnit says the idea that hypnosis can make people do things they don't want to is a myth.
We don't know the limitations of the mind yet, but we do know that we can accomplish almost anything the patient is willing to accomplish.
I'm going to count from 1 to 5, and as I do, you're slowly beginning to awaken. 4, feeling more and more alert within your body now. 5, eyes open and wide awake and alert. Happy, peaceful.
Oh, great. There's absolutely no pain, you know, because it's just another one. Yeah. I'm trying to get some, you know, eyes on it or something like that, and just, yeah, I mean, totally not.
Now, hypnotherapy is used for pain control, to control phobias, childbirth, and many other reasons. Now, Oregon does not require hypnotherapists to be licensed, so when choosing a therapist, patients should ask therapists about their experience and credentials before being treated.
Right, now, okay, looking at this point, I wonder if that could be me. Can anybody be hypnotized?
Yes and no, Paul. Dr. Schulman told me that people who don't want to be hypnotized probably aren't going to be a very good candidate, but he definitely calls a suggestibility evaluation on someone to see if they can be hypnotized. So I decided to do that. In this exercise, he had my arms out straight. This hand, you see, he told me that it had these books within it. And the other hand, he told me, was tied to an imaginary helium balloon. Now, as you'll see here in a minute, the right hand with the book in it, supposedly, it starts to go down. I was not moving my hand by myself. It did. I was under hypnosis, and he said, I was a good candidate. Also, you may wonder if people can go under that quickly. Now, Nick, the patient, that was not his first time. She went through a couple of sessions beforehand to sort of learn the techniques of relaxation.
So would you be willing to try it?
I did it.
Fascinating story.
In addition, we've done some more rather extensive dental work with a local Salem dentist in that same vein. There now exist in our state many out-of-state individuals who will certify hypnotherapists with a weekend of training to anyone who calls himself a certified hypnotherapist. This bill proposes a licensing board made up of 5 members, 4 of whom are members of the Oregon Hypnotherapy Association, which requires for membership a minimum of 150 hours of clinical training, which, among other subjects, teaches a curriculum of techniques and client assessment, contraindications for hypnosis, law and ethics, suggestibility testing, administration and record keeping, just to name a few. The above being a minimum, which, of course, does not include technical training. By example, a patient may come in suffering from anywhere from so low self-esteem to fear of commitment. If an unqualified individual leads the patient to believe that he or she was molested as a child, the patient will accept the information in a desire to please the therapist, even though the information is false. A well-trained hypnotherapist will not lead the patient, but will guide that person. An example of leading versus guide is as follows. After the patient has reached a relaxed state of tranquility, if the hypnotherapist is leading, he or she will then ask, "Who is that man or woman with you?" suggesting an answer. "What is he or she doing to you?" Again, suggesting an answer. To guide, the dialogue would be, "Where are you? Wait for an answer. Is there anyone with you? If not, change the scene. If so, it is a man or a woman, and wait for the answer. What is happening? And wait for the answer." The hypnotherapist will not make any suggestion to allow the patient to develop any memory, if any. If the practitioner is not well trained in simple age regression therapy, he or she can do a great deal of damage to the client by creating a situation that can exacerbate the trauma and cause additional problems to develop. The above, with leading rather than guiding, happens too often in the Washington example given earlier. The most important reason for this bill to succeed is for the protection of the public. Let us not let the state of Washington's story stand a chance to happen in Oregon. I thank you for this opportunity to testify before the committee and hope that I put my message across with stuttering and stammering.
Thank you. Any questions? On committee, what we failed to mention earlier, that when we are done with this bill, that we'll go to Ways and Means. So, Representative Cromwell, I am assuming you've got a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I actually have several, but I don't want to wear you out either.
I'm available by phone for questions.
Good.
Well, let me start off with just asking Dr. Solnick, what other states currently have licensing for hypnotherapists?
The state of Florida has a condition for practicing. The state of Indiana is presently undergoing a licensing bill. The state of Texas requires certain background for practicing. The state of Washington requires registration to practice.
Okay. And is there a national certifying body for hypnotherapists?
Yes, there is, the National Guild of Hypnotherapists. I'm on the advisory board for the New York State Hypnotherapy Association and the International Medical Dental Association.
Okay. And then, so do you, in your work, do you usually work with other medical providers?
Yes, Dr. Peterson is one example. I have a psychiatrist who had submitted a letter to Representative Cruz.
Okay.
And Dr. Lunt, the dentist that we worked with.
Okay. I'm looking at the fees, and I know that this isn't necessarily within our purview.
I'm going to get into that, and
I'm just curious if their members are. And
I want to get into that.
You do?
So yes.
Oh, okay.
So,
Can I ask a couple of other questions?
Two more.
I noticed that in section 2 that the board, that it says that none of the members of the board shall be psychologist associate or licensed professional counselor. I'm just curious as to why you're excluding other professionals from the board specifically.
Unfortunately, the training for hypnotherapists is rather specific. Most individuals who do hypnotherapy do not have that kind of training. They may have a great deal of training in psychology or other fields, and we don't go into that field. We won't go near it. If we have someone that needs that kind of work, we refer to them. We feel that the members of our board should know exactly what to expect from the psychotherapist.
Okay. I noticed that in section 9, It says that no person shall or may practice hypnotherapy or claim to be a licensed hypnotherapist unless they are in fact licensed by this act. I'm just curious, what happens to a person if they call themselves or they're practicing as a licensed?
At the present time, nothing, sir.
Under the law, if this were to become law, though,
that would become law, then they would be subject to the provisions of that law, which is probably jail.
Okay, I couldn't find it in there exactly.
See section 12, Representative.
Oh, okay.
No, you're done, Representative Walker. Let me tell the committee first off that this bill isn't going to pass out today, so there will be another opportunity. So, Representative Walker.
Thank you, Chair Cruz. My question is, I can't seem to define it for sure in the bill. Is this voluntary or is this mandatory licensure under the hypnosis board?
It would be mandatory.
It would be mandatory.
Yes, ma'am.
So if you have individuals, I'm sorry, follow-up questions. So if you have individuals as in section 9 that would be exempt from licensure or calling themselves licensed hypnotists or hypnotherapists, there are several categories here that would be exempt from that provision. Wouldn't there be some confusion, or it seems to me there'd be some confusion, if someone were practicing in a supervised course of study or in an organized group therapy type of situation, where they're using hypnosis, would these people be confused and think that by them representing themselves as being hypnotherapists, that they are in fact not licensed?
No, ma'am, that was the provision for the exclusion, so that those individuals could do that kind of work.
My question is, though, is the person who is participating in these groups or in these therapy situations, would they make the presumption that since there is a state licensure process, that someone that's calling themselves a hypnotherapist, they would maybe be presumed to be licensed? It would be like a dual system is what I'm getting, and would people be confused with a dual system?
I don't know how to answer that, to be quite honest with you.
Thank you.
I wish I could, but I...
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. Could you tell us what your credentials are in addition to your hypnotherapy background?
Yes. I've been practicing for over 30 years. I received my PhD in hypnotherapy from the International Board in Santa Ana in 19... I don't remember. I have to look at the degree.
Give us the decade?
In the 60s.
Thank you.
I'm a member of the advisory board of the New York State Hypnotherapy Association and the International Medical Dental Hypnotherapy Association. I hold a fellowship in the National Board of Hypnotic Anesthesiology. And I'm 72 years old.
Best credential yet. Follow up, Mr. Chair. Are you licensed in with some other health board or?
There is no licensing at all for hypnotherapy.
But you're not licensed as a psychologist or
no,
mental health counselor or in some other health board.
No, sir.
Okay, thank you.
What's your name, Melissa Anderson?
In your training, do you have to become a hypnotherapist? Do you have any training in mental health problems? Where I'm going is I have concerns, particularly for those individuals who have maybe mental health issues. Let's just take, for example, a bipolar disorder, where sometimes you have where the thought processes are or the chemical balance or whatever you say are not quite right. Do you have knowledge and training in that?
The knowledge that I have, and I would recommend for any other hypnotherapist, is that type of problem should be referred to the proper medical office. We wouldn't want to deal with that.
So you do have an assessment?
Yes, we have an assessment program to recognize what we cannot do.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And committee members, in your information, you've got curriculum and many of these things are answered in there. What's in the regard?
Doctor, it's my understanding that required membership in a state of Oregon, if this bill went forward, would be voluntary on behalf of the hypnotherapists. Is that correct?
Membership in the Oregon Hypnotherapy Association would be voluntary, but licensing would not be. Did that confuse you at all, Representative?
Well, it's just that I was just reading ahead, so to speak, and there's criticism that, which I agree with, that voluntary boards aren't going to do anything but spend people's time and taxpayer money.
We would hope not. We have suggested in the proposal that four of the members of that board be members of the association for no compensation at all on a voluntary basis. We would like to police our own if we may.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, can you tell us how one gets a PhD in hypnotherapy?
At the present time, it's not available. When I went through the American Institute of Hypnotherapy, it was a degree that was offered by the state of California. Since then, the school has changed it to DCH, Doctor of Clinical Hypnotherapy. I might add that the state of Oregon does not recognize these degrees.
follow up, please?
Yeah.
So how does one get to the point that you were suggesting where one would be licensed? What kind of education would one go through?
We have a minimum in the association for 150 hours of professional training. We happen to have two individuals here today who operate schools of hypnotherapy in Portland. And if you'd like to know their criteria, I'm sure they'd be glad to testify.
May I observe?
Thank you. What are the various names that hypnotists, and I'll use a hypnotist, use to advertise? I mean, hypnotherapy is a very specific, but I can imagine people advertising in a variety of ways.
Representative, may I define the difference between a hypnotist and a hypnotherapist? A hypnotist is an entertainer. His motivation is to entertain people. When he does his work, the volunteers that usually volunteer are fun-loving, outgoing people who've never been on a stage before in their life, and this is a wonderful opportunity for them to have fun. They say they don't remember, but I can assure you they remember everything they do. A hypnotherapist uses the technique of deep relaxation for therapeutic use. There is a definite difference between a hypnotist and a hypnotherapist. Most advertising of hypnotherapists is done either by yellow page advertising or by word of mouth. My particular method is only by referral. My referral source comes from former patients or physicians in the area.
Committee, I'm going to kind of cut this off because we got a lot on our plate today. Doctor, I obviously think there's merit here. I wouldn't have been one of the co-sponsors of the bill, but what we got as far as what this is going to cost for you guys to do this, and it's fairly standard, but basically what we're looking at, assuming 47 members of your association, the annual fee is going to be $1,500 per member for this to take place, and for the health licensing office to administer it. So what I need from you is I need to know if members are willing to pay a fee like that. First and foremost, before we can go here, and I would be willing to have discussions, and I'm going to call Sue Wilson up next to talk about that. But this is standard. So be willing to have those discussions, but I kind of have a policy. I don't impose fees or fee increases on anybody without them being willing to pay them. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sue?
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Susan Wilson, Director of the Health Licensing Office. We operate an independent agency that provides services, administrative services, licensing, and regulatory services for boards. HB 2625, as we read the bill, and we may be incorrect, but there are several exemptions, creates a voluntary board rather than a mandatory licensing set of standards, and we believe those exemptions are found on page 9. We just have a series of issues that relate to this board. We are not offering testimony as proponents or opponents of this bill because we believe very strongly in public protection. So if I could go over those quickly with you. The Oregon Hypnotherapy Association forecasts about 47 members currently within the state of Oregon that would qualify under this act. Those members would need to choose to qualify under this act the way we read the bill. If they did not choose to use the title of hypnotherapist and wanted to use other titles which are exempt under Section 9, they could continue to practice. And we're assuming that the thrust of this bill is to provide public protection. I want to use an example of direct entry midwives. They do have a voluntary licensing program. The reason voluntary licensing doesn't work is if a member decides, and this has been the case with the direct entry midwives, there was an adverse enforcement action, they decided not to get licensed. In the state of Oregon, we cannot prosecute after they've decided not to become licensed. They can still practice. They can't call themselves a licensed direct entry midwife, but we cannot do anything to the person that may have an enforcement action, which I'm assuming that's why this bill is being presented, and I understand the group that is here in support of this bill. I think it's very important to have public protection, but you have to make sure you have the law that allows you to provide that public protection. So our main concern is the 47 licensees and the amount of money those 47 licensing individuals would have to pay, and that we couldn't count on that core. There's no reason that they would have to become licensed. It could be 10 licensees that decided to be licensed rather than 47 because it's not mandatory. The financial issues are key. The mandatory versus voluntary are key. And then there's just a few licensing issues that we could fix very easily with an amendment, and that is they have the director in this particular case appointing the board members. We see that as a political challenge. The governor is the person that appoints board members in the state of Oregon. That works very well in the balance in the office of the administration, and the board members are appointed by the governor. So we would suggest that as a change if this board bill does go forward. I would be happy to answer questions rather than go into any more detail with my testimony.
Sue, would you be willing to work with Dr. Skolnick to figure out ways to...
Chairman Cruz, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
If I may, I'm looking at lines 21 and 22 on page 3 of the bill, in which it says that no person may practice hypnotherapy or claim to be a licensed hypnotherapist unless the person is licensed, except, and then it has a bunch of exceptions,
yes,
which are in the healthcare field fairly standard exceptions. I mean, they basically would allow a psychologist to practice hypnotherapy because that's within the scope of a psychologist's normal work, and a minister and various other people are exempted, which is pretty standard. I'm wondering why you think this is a voluntary law when the law very explicitly states that you can't practice hypnotherapy or claim to be a licensed hypnotherapist unless you are licensed or unless you meet one of the exceptions.
And Chair Cruz and Representative Barnhart, I want to say that we have spent some time talking to individuals in the association. We may be under a misunderstanding. And again, when I read the bill too, it didn't look quite as bad as it sounded when we had the conversation. So I would be willing to make sure if an amendment needs to be added that with the language was very clear that it would not be voluntary as opposed to mandatory. But our first read of the bill was that it appeared to be voluntary and that the core group was only 47 and that we could not count on that 47 based on the exemptions within the law. We could be incorrect, and we'd be happy to look at that issue.
And a follow-up, if I may. I just want to make sure I understand your position. Do you have a position on whether or not the bill should be voluntary or mandatory?
Chair Cruz, Representative Barnhart, absolutely, we believe that in order to have public protection, you need to have a mandatory program.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
But you don't think this does that?
The way it's written, I believe there's some room for question.
Thank you, Sue. Go forth and do good things.
May I ask one more question?
Yeah, okay.
I'm sorry. This is, again, by way of follow-up. I notice in, actually it isn't, it's a different topic. I notice on page 2, section 4, lines, let's see, where am I? On lines 17 and 18, sub 2, establish training. This is the hypnotherapy board's powers. It's a power to establish training, education, and fitness standards for issuance, renewal, or revival of licenses and for reciprocal licenses. Now, I notice in that section, and I can't find anywhere else in this bill anything that actually prescribes what the qualifications for hypnotherapist actually is. It looks as though this bill allows the board to establish that. My experience is, and I'm going to ask you about your experience, my experience is that for other health licensing boards, at least an outline of what the requirements are in order to get licensed within that board. For example, in psychology, in ORS 675.030, there's a column that describes what you have to, what your license, what your educational background and training background has to be in order to become a psychologist. Is your experience that other licensing boards have such broad powers to define what the license is for as this one would have under this section?
Chair Cruz, Representative Bernard, I think that boards come in many different styles and ways of writing their language. I will say this. I do believe that minimum competency standards are generally outlined within the law as it relates to the practice.
And that's generally not true in this law, is it?
That is not true in this law.
Thank you.
Which is something that would need to be fixed.
Representative Morsas, thank you. I want to go back to the title and what people would call themselves, and you alluded to that. You said someone may use a different title. Now, if someone used a different title and did hypnotherapy work, I understand you would have no way of dealing with that individual.
Chair Cruz and Representative Morsas, we believe that, no, that we would not have any way of pursuing the enforcement action based on another title or falling under some of the exemptions they've listed here. Yes, that is our concern and fear.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to close the public hearing on 26-25. And I'm going to open a work session on 25-15. Diane?
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, House Bill 2515 directs the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to designate funds to support programs and foundations that promote access to health care in rural areas. We have a -1 amendment that adds an effective date to the bill of July 1st, 2001. And you wanted to add it. Is the name for this bill?
Yeah.
And the amendment that also exists?
The -1.
We have a -2 amendment that has just came out today that we'll be giving you on 2515 that adds a dollar amount.
Colleagues, we heard this before, the Rural Healthcare Trust Fund.
Mm-hmm.
We've had conversations with DAFT about their ability to administer it, which is up to, which they can do and are willing to do. Unfortunately, DAFT's budget is already through the process, so that made it impossible for us to add it to their budget. Which is why we're adding the section in the -2s. The dollar amount is what we were going to designate for this fund all along. You need to know that the target source for this is the upper limits Medicaid dollars. And you also need to know that this is a fund that has a sunset on it. Oregon pretty much has to max it out this year, and then over the next 5 years, the feds decrease it by 20% a year, so it will go away. What we're looking at as of this point in time is a one-time allocation to establish this fund. Representative Barnhart, you look like you have a question.
Mr. Chair, is this part of the mule money?
Yes.
Thank you.
Oh, I was trying to use a slightly more technical term.
Well, I know the word mule, but I don't know
okay.
the technical
okay.
term. So.
Are there any other questions?
Boy.
Representative Lee.
Yes, Mr. Chair, was there someone that was opposed to these amendments? I thought I heard some discussion prior to the meeting. Is that on this bill?
On this bill, there's an amendment to 2516 that there was some opposition to.
Okay.
I know that. I'm not aware of opposition
okay.
here.
I think that's what I'm thinking of.
Mr. Chair, I would move -1 amendments. The -1.
Yeah, we're in work session.
Well, Dash two includes dash one, doesn't it?
Well,
dash two, and
yes,
include the emergency effective date.
So he moved the dash two.
We did.
It just didn't sound like it at the time.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. I was under a out over here.
Were you hit? Senator Barnhart.
Am I misremembering, or are we talking about money which in the governor's budget and in the co-chair's budget is already allocated for something else? Myra.
Theoretically, Representative Barnhart, it is, but also in neither budget do I think they have estimated the amount of mule to be what it will turn out to be.
You think that we're going to end up with more money?
Yes, and...
I see.
And keep in mind that by doing this, we're securing a portion of this fund for the folks who are giving another portion of it to the state almost free. So mule's a brokered deal. It doesn't happen without signatures on the line. So this is not secure funding at this point in time. But we hope that this is going to go a long way towards making that secure funding. Representative Walker.
Can we clarify this a little bit?
Sure.
This dash two says the $20 million allocation, and we've already passed the budget for the stream of money that this was supposed to have come out of. Is that correct?
No.
I'm confusing the statements. Would you clarify the budget for that?
This fund, the dollars in this fund will be administered by DAS,
right? Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We passed the DAS budget.
This has nothing to do with the DAS budget, except that they're the ones who will administer the fund. And for other funds that they administer, like for Oregon Public Broadcast and different folks like that, the dollar amount and the authority is in their budget bill.
But not the money itself.
Yeah, the dollar amount is there. But we couldn't, I mean, this isn't part of the DAS budget. This is another fund, and all they're doing is administering it. We're including this, so the authority exists for them to administer the fund. Yes.
So where does it come from? Where does the $20 million come from?
It comes out of Mule.
And Mule is?
The upper limits Medicaid dollars.
Upper limits.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
The amendment says general fund. Wouldn't we have to put the specific program instead of general fund?
No, it will go in the general fund.
The mule money goes to the general fund?
Yes, it does. Yeah, it does.
But the only reason for mentioning mule is where specifically the money that's going into the general fund is coming from. Representative Morris Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Why is it then that we put a dollar amount in this amendment then? I'm confused with why, because I know before we had it blank, which I was very comfortable with because we didn't know how much of the mule money we would be able to use, and now we have a set amount of $20 million. What other programs would that prevent not being used or being funded?
I can't answer that. That's a ways and means decision. What we are doing with this is we are saying that we think that this fund should be created and that this amount is an appropriate amount to put in the fund. Us passing this does not mean it happens. This goes to Ways and Means, and they will either pass it or not. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm definitely in favor of creating a fund for our rural clinics. I mean, there's such a need. I
I'm just sort of surprised at the $20 million. I guess that's
the representative putting the $20 million in was my idea. I suggested it. I put it in the amendment. I think it's the appropriate amount. I have talked to the co-chair, and I think it is what is going to happen. The co-chair knows this is coming. Now we any other discussion?
Yeah. Well, I call for the question.
Okay. The vote is on the dash two amendment, the House Bill 2515. Are there any objections?
I would object to the amendment.
Okay. So noted.
Okay. I would move House Bill 2515 with the adoption of the dash two amendment to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Morissette has moved 2515 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Part of my difficulty with this measure is the amount being allocated here. This is the thing that's always confusing as we talk about monies, because we deal with policy issues, and Ways and Means are supposed to deal with the money allocation. This is an important item, and I think it's a very important item. There are other items that are more important to me and that are also significantly underfunded in the budgets that I know about. And it's difficult for me to vote for an item like this when I don't know what the effect of it might be on those other areas of even greater concern in a tight budget. And maybe that's just because we're not on Ways and Means, and I don't understand how this item fits in with all the others. And so that puts me in kind of a dilemma, I guess, as I think about this issue. While I certainly agree that this is a very important item, one that we ought to support, whether I'm ready to support it to the tune of $20 million is a different question.
Representative, for the Ways and Means Committee to make substantive changes in bills we send them, they have to have the agreement of the chair of the committee it came from. For them to change a dollar amount, they don't. Representative Lee.
I'm still uncomfortable with the amount. Couldn't we send it down with a blank in it so that it gets balanced with the other allocations that need to be made, or that we have an opportunity to have some more information?
Mr. Chair, could I?
Representative Morissette.
In speaking with the chair of Ways and Means, Representative Winters, about a number of bills that I have an interest in that would be funded out of the tobacco settlement money, she, and even the K-12 budget, it's her position that these things are going to be on the shelf until there is a clearer picture of the needs that are still coming in. And then, fortunately or unfortunately, they will be making some decisions, and I guess we have to track that. But I agree with Representative Cruz that, you know, if this is the amount that we think this bill deserves, the only thing I can think of is to send it to Ways and Means. I don't have that discomfort, and letting it live or die on its merits in terms of funding. We've done our job, I think, by looking at the substantive issues of this bill, and I feel very comfortable with that, and I don't have a problem with the money amount, simply because that will be taken care of by another body when we can give input to that.
And I would like to say, committee, that when we did our tour of rural Oregon and looked at facilities, 20 is a minimalist amount here. It truly is.
Yeah.
We're on the verge of losing hospitals altogether.
Yeah.
You know, and for us to not to make a strong stand for health care in rural Oregon, which this is, I think it's shirking our duty. Representative Mona Sanderson.
Yes, and I will vote for the bill, but I wanted it on record that I voted against the $20 million. I like having the amendment with not a designated amount for it, and so that's why I went against the $20 million.
And it was so noted.
Yeah.
May I say, And I should have addressed for you that part of the background of this bill, because I too was on that tour, and we visited hospitals, and they are in dire straits, and we are in danger of losing health facilities in rural Oregon, and this bill will help in preserving some of them. So I very much support that.
Any other discussion? Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that it's important that we do put a dollar amount in to show the importance of a need in rural Oregon. I too was on that tour, saw some facilities that, quite frankly, I'm not sure how they're staying open. I'm also not sure how they're meeting some of the requirements that are out there for facilities to have to meet. And I think that we do need to show that there is a concern for rural health care in that respect. I think that there's a lot of other ideas that can also be kicked around, but within the purview of this bill, one of the things with regards to the money, I would point out that if this were to come out of mule money, my understanding is that there's about $58 million that'll be coming through. So that still leaves about $38 million that could be used in other aspects. The other thing is that, if I also understand mule money correctly, is that there's a little loophole in the federal law. And basically, mule money comes in, and then it can be kind of stuck into the general fund and used anywhere. What this is doing is saying, we want to make sure that some of that money, when it comes into the state of Oregon, actually goes into health care, which is where it was intended by Congress to be used, and not just stuck in the general fund and used somewhere else. And I do have to take a minor exception to the comments that we have been hearing all session long and since December about how tight of a budget we have. Our revenues have gone up 13%. If my personal revenues went up 13%, God, I'd love it. Somehow that, and every year we come into the building, and it's a tight budget. And we could come in here with $50 million or $50 billion in a budget, and we'd still be hearing how tight the budget is. I think that one thing that we really do need to do in this particular bill is make a statement that we want those Medicaid dollars that are coming from the feds used for Medicaid programs, not just stuck in the general fund and used somewhere else, to wherever they may go. $20 million is a small amount. I'd say put 40 or 50 of the $58 million in there, but that's not my decision to make. So I do support the bill. Enthusiastically.
$20 million is a broker deal. Representative Gerard.
I want to thank Representative Crumble for taking my entire speech away in his last 10 seconds. I am the only Eastern Oregon legislator on this committee, and I'm astounded at the fact that we aren't doing exactly as Representative Crumble said. I would be happy if this were $50 million, and then I'd be working for $75 and $100 because of the need. But I know our entire state has need. But this is just fair for Eastern Oregon, and it's the right thing to do. This is the way we can acquire some kind of, or reach some kind of point where we're close to adequate funding of the health needs in Eastern Oregon. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm very much in favor of this.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I strongly support that we do whatever we reasonably can do for the health care needs of our rural, the rural parts of our state, just as we need to do in the urban parts of our state. And I don't want anybody to think that my remarks indicated anything else. As I look at the overall budget, I think that it's an extremely tight budget. If I had my druthers, I would raise somewhere between $200 and $300 million more for K-12 education, $150 million more for higher education, including community colleges, as a minimum. I would be adding, and these are minimum numbers, I would be adding money for SDSD, very substantial amounts of money.
yes, our the actual dollar figure that we have coming in has gone up. The people of the state of Oregon, in their great wisdom through Measure 5, Measure 11, Measure 17, have spent that money. And it's spent. And so we're stuck with, we have the privilege of dealing with services that various transfers to other parts of supports in the state that were voted on by the people. You would think that the amount of money we have should be plenty, but for those reasons, it's not. And the result of that is that many areas of the budget, which are seriously underfunded, are going to continue to be seriously underfunded. Doesn't mean I don't support this concept. It means that I think we need to be careful, judicious, and that we make good decisions to do the very best we can with the limited, very limited resources we have for the benefit of all Oregonians. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart concerns me, Representative Leeson, Representative Monas Anderson. I would be much more comfortable passing this on without a figure which seems to be, I can't understand where it came from. It just sort of came out of a hat. And I don't understand where it came from and how it applies. I agree, the rural hospitals are definitely in need. I wasn't able to go on the tour that some of you did, but I'm, after hearing the testimony that we did a few weeks ago, I'm very much aware of the need. But I guess I'm still very uncomfortable about where that figure came from and what it means. And hearing that it's $20 million of $58 million of mule funds doesn't make me feel comforted that a third of this, well, a third of the Medicare funds would go for this. So if it were not a dollar amount, I would be voting for this. But since I'm uncomfortable with the $20 million amount, I will be voting against.
Thank you. Actually, committee, the mule, the estimate on the mule is somewhere between 70 and 80, but that's not a relevant fact. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Walker?
Yes.
Representative Tomei?
No.
Representative Crummel?
Aye.
Representative Morissa?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Montanson?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart?
No.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. House Bill 2516, having received the required majority, has passed and sent to the Committee on Ways and Means, and I'll close the work session on 2515 and open a work session on 2516.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, House Bill 2516 establishes a not-for-profit rural health foundation. It creates a board of directors for the foundation and authorizes grants to be awarded to rural health care providers by the foundation. You have just three amendments. In the amendments, we're defining rural health care provider as being a not-for-profit or publicly owned. We're defining rural health care provider as being eligible for a tax credit under certain RS provisions. Create a grant application review committee that is appointed by the Rural Health Foundation. We require the board to consider ranking of grant applications before those grants are awarded. And it adds an effective date of July 1st, 2001. This bill originally has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. There are no dollars in the bill.
The committee, the referral was put on the wrong one. we will need to rescind the referral. Originally, the referral was on 2515 or 2516 when it should have been on 2515. So it's easy to send something that doesn't have a referral, but we got to rescind it if it does. So that's a small piece of business we got to do. Discussion. Question. Representative Barnhart.
This one, I think this is a small issue. One of the things that came up in testimony on this bill, and I got it in the wrong file, so I haven't had a chance to really look at it carefully. I put it in 2515. One of the items of testimony was on the issue of whether or not these organizations ought to be publicly operated. And as I read the -3 amendments, it makes it very clear that they don't have to be publicly operated. And I'm trying to remember now what the reasoning was behind the idea that they should be.
May I respond? My memory is that we had Rose Jade who spoke to us.
Yep.
Is that?
That's who it is. That's right. Who it was, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, as I recall, Mr. Chair, she objected to the idea that the funds here might go in not to a publicly operated program, but to a privately operated program with limitations on its scope of action because of the nature of the organization that it emanated from.
Is Karen Whitaker here? I'm looking. Oh, there you are. Okay, I was looking too far forward. Would you like to address the question?
I would be happy to. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Karen Whitaker, and I'm the director of the Office of Rural Health. I think this amendment may have some unintended consequences. I know it was most likely directed at a specific situation, which has since been resolved.
Oh, good.
And
you're referring to the -1.
The -3.
No.
Or the
-1.
I'm looking at the -1s, Mr. Chair.
I don't have the -1.
That's the one, Representative Barnhart, that adds the "and operated" language to.
Barnhart, it came from your office.
I know it did, and I can't find it.
The fact is there are a number of rural hospitals who have various types of management agreements with larger health systems because they often lack the resources in their own areas to have a good management staff, and they also obtain a lot of economies of scale by affiliating with a larger system. So the question of what operated means, I think, would be an issue. Many of them are management contracts. There are 13 rural hospital districts in the state. Offhand, I can think of probably half a dozen who would be excluded from the benefits of this bill if this amendment were passed.
The -1 amendment.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Karen?
I'm sorry, I don't have the -1 amendment to.
We're having copies of
it. Can you just read it? It looks like
the -1,
right,
and it says on page 1 of the printed bill, line 7, before the semicolon, insert "and operated."
What line?
Line 7, before the semicolon, insert the words "and operated."
Okay, so I do have a question. And how do you feel like Rose Jade's concerns are addressed by that change?
Representative Tomei, Representative Cruz, I believe she was concerned about a non-public entity operating a public hospital.
May I follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. As I recall, her specific concern was that it was a Catholic entity that was running a public hospital that would not provide information about birth control or family planning or end-of-life decisions.
That was her specific concern, Representative Tomei.
So how does this address that?
What this bill would do would make any district hospital that is funded with tax dollars that has any type of affiliation or even management agreement with any other system ineligible for benefits under the Rural Health Foundation.
Well, you've lost me.
I'm sorry. That was a long sentence, wasn't it?
With the inclusion of the -1s.
With the inclusion of the -1s, about half of our rural district hospitals would not be eligible for benefits under this bill because they have many of them management agreements, so they're not strictly operated by the health district. They may be operated by a larger healthcare system with which they have a management agreement. I can't speak to how that would affect the scope of services. And in most cases, I don't believe it affects the scope of services at all. Ms. Jade was concerned about one specific situation on the Oregon coast.
Right.
And that situation has since, the hospital system in question has since withdrawn its negotiations. So I'm
confused. Are you in support of the Dash One Amendment or opposed?
Oh, I'm sorry. I am opposed to them.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Mona Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding rural hospitals, is in the MUL money, the Medicaid upper limits money, does the rural hospitals, most of their funding come from Medicaid or not?
Representative Monis Anderson, Mr. Chair, I think it would vary from hospital to hospital. When you combine Medicare and Medicaid, most of the rural hospitals look at 60% to 70% of their revenue coming from Medicare or Medicaid, combined together. Certainly, they are more dependent on Medicaid than the urban hospitals are, because we have a disproportionate number of Medicaid recipients living in rural areas.
And in some cases, I think probably up to 80%.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think after that explanation, I'm not proposing that we consider the Dash One Amendment.
Okay. Well, any other questions or comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Morissette.
Well, I would move the Dash 3 amendment.
2560. Representative Morissette has moved the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2516. Is there any further discussion or questions? Are there any objections? Hearing none, the Dash 3s are adopted. Representative Morissette.
Well, I guess we have to rescind the sending of this 2516 to Ways and Means.
Right.
So I would move that we rescind.
Representative Morissette has moved to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion or objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Morissette.
I would move 2516 to the floor of the House for the due passage.
Representative Morissette has moved House Bill 2516 as amended to the floor for due pass recommendation. Are there any more discussion? Hearing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Walker?
Yes.
Representative
Comey? Yes.
Representative
Summer? Aye.
Representative
Morrison? Aye. Representative Gerard? Aye. Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. House Bill 2516, having received the required majority, is declared passed. My name's on the bill. Representative Morissette, would you like to carry?
Yes.
Representative Morissette will carry the bill, and I'll close the work session on 2516. And colleagues, we're going to go a little bit out of order because we got some folks that are on some time constraints here. So I'm going to open a public hearing on 3051. Diane.
And members of the committee, House Bill 3051 authorizes the Office for Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research to sponsor studies of healthcare utilization and quality improvement. Declares an emergency effective July 1, 2001. You have amendments to the bill. They are Dash 1 amendments. And we have people here to speak on this.
Welcome. Please, go ahead.
Thank you. Chairman Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm the chair of the Oregon Healthcare Purchasers Coalition and a member of the board of directors of the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation. I'm here to speak on behalf of the bill before you. The bill authorizes, and there's a packet, you should have a packet available that kind of goes through a summary of this. The bill authorizes the Office for Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research to sponsor studies of healthcare utilization and quality improvement. And it's the interest of the coalition of purchasers to drive toward quality, because we believe that in the long term, and hopefully in the near term in some cases, that will drive down and control price and cost increases, many of those double digits nowadays for our purchasers. The proposed amendment would allow them to sponsor this kind of data collection and gathering, and the kinds of things that are important to controlling practice variation in medicine, evidence-based protocols, similar methodologies that can improve medical outcomes and cost effectiveness, and then improve consistency and effectiveness of medical interventions, including new and emerging medical technologies. Evidence-based medicine also, as it comes to formularies and the way that prescriptions are rendered, so that there can be good medicine practice, but good cost containment as well. The bill doesn't direct the office to take or to undertake the studies themselves, but just actually be able to sponsor that. We think it's important to have an entity as important in the state as the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy to be able to be a sponsor that would look across the opportunities within the state of organizations, not-for-profit purchasing organizations, and so on, medical entities that are doing quality-based studies, and be able to sponsor it in a way that draws some of those entities together and gets a good broad-based perspective on the information. The Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation was formed for that purpose, so we possibly could be one of the areas that would be referred to do some studying, but not certainly the only one. So the preponderance of what we have gathered so far as a coalition is that there is a lot of individual quality-based studies going on across the state by health plans and by doctor groups, and we have a doctor group represented here with us that's going to speak to this in just a little bit. But by having them come together with that information, doesn't reinvent the wheel, doesn't duplicate costs, and it focuses all of that information through the resolution or to the resolution of one of these practices for a major disease, so that it's all brought together. So we really wholeheartedly support this, and we recommend your support in getting that passed. Thank you. I'm glad to take questions or just introduce the other speakers here and let them.
Any questions for Mr. Griff? Okay, move on.
Representative Garrard.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Representative Garrard. Question I have in looking through this, you just stated that a lot of individual studies are going on. If these individual studies are going on, and I know a lot of insurance companies, a lot of medical groups, and all those people have data, a lot of data, why do we need to do an additional study that the state pays for when the data are already available, and particularly if they're working with the Oregon Health Plan already?
I'm going to let Dr. Erickson answer that, because he's well familiar with some of that information firsthand.
Okay.
That's okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Gary Erickson. I'm the Chief Medical Director of the Interhospital Physicians Association, which is the largest IPA in Oregon with 1,400 physicians based in Portland. I'm also a board member of the Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation. And to specifically answer your question, Representative Walker, Oregon has been in the forefront of states over the last few years doing cooperative initiatives. And I think a good example is the Oregon Medical Association's ARC committee that has put together statewide credentialing packets so that physicians can fill out one application for all payers. The Oregon Healthcare Quality Corporation has tried to do the same thing. We have multiple members from many different organizations, so that there's Blue Cross representatives, Pacific Care representatives, Providence representatives, and multiple IPAs. Each one of us is doing a study